listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Welcome to the reading of the Council Bluffs Nonpareil for Tuesday, September 29th. I'm Kylie from Drake University. Here is our first story. Two dead, 10 injured after shooting inside club in Waterloo on Saturday. Two people died from their injuries and another 10 were hurt when at least two people began shooting at each other inside a private club in Waterloo. Police said Monday that the second person to die at a hospital this weekend was a woman from outside Waterloo, the Waterloo Cedar Rapids Courier reported. A 22-year-old Waterloo man also died at a hospital after being shot. No arrests have been made. The shooting occurred about 3:15 a.m. Saturday, according to police. Authorities estimated that about 100 people were at the club when gunfire erupted inside following a confrontation. They said the building is a former bar that was being used by a motorcycle club as an unauthorized nightclub. This incident was the result of at least two individuals recklessly shooting at each other inside and outside the building, the police said in a statement Sunday. Past STARS scholarship recipient gives back as program director in CB. Although classes are underway at most colleges, the STARS scholarship program, administered by the Council Bluffs Schools Foundation, is still accepting applications, according to Mia Lostrup, program director. Until we have a full roster, we're accepting applications, she said. The program accepts up to 50 students and currently has 46 with another application pending, she said. 19 are new to the program this year. Our program is targeted toward those non-traditional students who have waited or finally found that passion that they want to go into, she said. The STAR Scholarship Program was created in 1997 by the Iowa West Foundation, which provides its funding. It is open to the Pottawatomi County custodial parents or grandparents with a child who is younger than 18 or can be claimed as a dependent on their tax return. Applicants must be U.S. citizens, at least 20 years old, and graduates of a high school or high school equivalency program. They must also be planning to be a full-time student or defined by the college or trade school they attend, and must qualify for the Pell Grant or another kind of public assistance. They must meet majors or career fields that will significantly increase their family income. Current scholars include 16 studying nursing, 4 in psychology, 3 in education, 2 in human resources management, and the rest in general studies, business administration, or undeclared majors. The awards of up to $3,500 can be used for tuition or any other school-related expense, including books, supplies, equipment, tools, software, uniforms, professional dues, exam fees, child care, or transportation. The STARS program also helps students apply for internships. Recipients can also attend seminars on financial literacy and professional development. Lostrup, who was born and raised in Council Bluffs, is herself a former STARS scholar, she said. I was a hairstylist and struggling to pay for child care, she said. Lostrup decided to further her education and found a part-time job working in child care. That's when I kind of found my passion, she said. She decided to major in education after graduating and continuing as a stylist for a while. Lostrup worked in child development at West Central Community Action. Then she got a passion at AIM and worked with 500 Wilson Middle School and Thomas Jefferson High School students in a talent search program. That led to her position at the Council Bluffs School Foundation, which she started last year. As a recipient of the STAR Scholarship in 2012 to 2014, I'm thankful for the opportunity to give back to the foundation that helps me grow as a professional in the community, she said. My goal is to help pave the way for a successful experience and guide scholars on their pathway to career success. Lostrup is currently chairwoman of the Human Services Advisory Council Communications Committee and a member of Leadership Council Bluffs Class 33. She and her husband, Brian, live in Council Bluffs with their 3 sons, Hayden, 16, Dominique, 4, and Benson, 3. Next we have Sioux City man pleads not guilty to fatal shooting. A Sioux City man has pleaded not guilty to fatally stabbing another man and seriously injuring a woman. Michael Landrum, 54, entered his written plea Thursday in Woodbury County District Court to single counts of first-degree murder, attempted murder, and willful injury causing serious injury. A trial date has not been set. District Judge 7, Adreason, has been appointed to preside over the case. Landrum is charged with stabbing Salihaden Adam, 37, on September 11th at 2103 Nebraska Street. He is also accused of stabbing Natasha Drapeau, 43, who was hospitalized with serious injuries after the incident. According to court documents, Landrum has been at a party with the two at Drapeau's apartment. After leaving, he returned to look for his mistress and missing cell phone and became upset with Adam and Drapeau, accusing them of taking it. Landrum left the apartment again and returned at 12:55 a.m., pounding at the door. And when Drapeau answered it, Landrum stabbed her multiple times with a steak-style knife. When Adam came to her assistance, Landrum stabbed him multiple times, court documents said. Police found Landrum walking in the 2400 block of Nebraska Street about 2 hours after the incident and arrested him without incident. If found guilty of first-degree murder, Landrum would face a mandatory sentence of life in prison without parole. Sioux City murder trial rescheduled to a new date. A Carroll, Iowa man accused of killing a Sioux City homeowner is now scheduled to stand trial in January. Gary Danes, Jr., 46, had been scheduled to stand trial on charges of first-degree murder, commission of a specified unlawful activity, second-degree theft, and first-degree burglary in October. His trial is now set for January 19th. The continuation has been requested by his new attorneys, public defenders Andrew Mungler and Joseph Reedy, after Danes' previous attorney had to withdraw because of an overseas military deployment. Danes remains in the Woodbury County Jail on a $1 million bond. He is accused of killing Paul Smith, 65, on July 16, 2019, during a fight after he broke into Smith's home at 314 20th Street and later took $120 and Smith's Ford Explorer. An autopsy report listed the cause of death as blunt force injuries to the head and neck. Strangulation also was a probable component, the report said. Police found Smith's body after responding to a call from Danes' strangled wife, who rented another room in Smith's building and said she was worried because she hadn't seen him for a while and witnessed Danes driving vehicle Smith. Smith's Explorer was located in the possession of two women, one of whom told a policeman with injuries to his head had given it to her in return for her kindness to him. The Muppets are coming, other fuzzy friends too, as Durham Museum celebrates Jim Henson. It's time to play the music. It's time to light the lights. It's time to meet the Muppets and other fuzzy friends at the Durham Museum next month. It's all part of a traveling exhibition opening October 3rd in celebration of America's most widely known visionary entertainer, Jim Henson. Organized by Museum of the Moving Image, MOMI, the exhibition will be in view through January 10th. The Jim Henson exhibition, Imagination Unlimited, explores Henson's groundbreaking work for film and television and his transformative impact on popular culture. It had its world premiere in 2017, and Omaha is the fifth location to officially host it, said Jessica Brummer, director of communications for the museum. It's a big deal for us, and one I think will bring a lot of joy, Brummer said. Visitors will see how Henson and his team of builders, performers, and writers brought to life the enduringly popular worlds of The Muppet Show, Sesame Street, Fraggle Rock, The Dark Crystal, Labyrinth, and more. The exhibition also includes material from Henson's experimental film projects and his early work as a restless creative performer, filmmaker, and technical innovator. Among the artifacts are more than 20 puppets, character sketches, storyboards, scripts, photographs, film, and television clips. Behind-the-scenes footage, iconic costumes, and interactive experiences that allow visitors to their hand at puppeteering on camera and designing a puppet character. To safely accommodate all guests, access to the museum will be timed entry. Tickets available on a first-come served basis are available up to 5 days in advance at durhammuseum.org. The Jim Henson exhibition is included with regular museum admission. Here's your forecast. Temps continue to drop throughout the week. Temps in the 70s today, 60s on Thursday, and Fridays, 50 degrees. Today, a high of 72 is expected with a west wind that could gust as high as 20 miles per hour at times, according to the National Weather Service in Valley, Nebraska. Tonight will be mostly clear with a low of 51. The Council Bluffs, Omaha area could see frost early Friday morning. The forecast, according to the Weather Service, today, sunny with a high near 72, light west wind increasing to 8 to 13 miles per hour in the morning. Winds could gust as high as 20 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly clear with a low around 51. West-northwest wind, 3 to 6 miles per hour. Wednesday, sunny with a high near 71. Light west-northwest wind becoming north-northwest, 12 to 17 miles per hour in the morning. Winds could gust as high as 26 miles per hour. Wednesday night, clear with a low around 43. Thursday, sunny with a high near 60 degrees. Thursday night, areas of frost after 5 a.m. Otherwise, mostly clear with a low of 36. Friday, areas of frost before 8 a.m. Otherwise, sunny with a high near 58. Friday night, partly cloudy with a low of around 40. Saturday, a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms. Mostly sunny with a high near 63. Saturday night, partly cloudy with a low around 42. Sunday, mostly sunny with a high near 61. Potawatomi County reports 39th COVID-19 death. A 39th Potawatomi County resident has died after contracting COVID-19. The Iowa Department of Public Health's COVID-19 website listed the death Monday. Potawatomi County Public Health Director Matt Wyatt said a Council Bluffs man between 41 and 60 years old died last week. In southwest Iowa, there have been 5 deaths in both Crawford and Montgomery counties, 3 deaths in Harrison County, 2 in Cass County, and 1 in Mills, Monona, and Shelby counties. According to the state COVID-19 website, Potawatomi County was at 2,148 positive COVID-19 cases out of 21,308 tests at 3 p.m. Monday. There have been 1,737 recoveries. Iowa was at 86,993 positive cases out of 786,960 tests on Monday. The state noted that over the weekend, it updated its data with nearly 27,000 antigen test results from surveillance testing at long-term care facilities in Iowa. There have been 66,311 recoveries and 1,320 deaths. The Associated Press reported Monday the state saw more than 600 new cases and 2 additional deaths over a 24-hour period. On Friday, Governor Kim Reynolds signed a new emergency proclamation that extends bar closures in Johnson County stores for at least another week, the AP reported. Those counties are home to the University of Iowa and Iowa State and have seen a surge in confirmed coronavirus cases. Iowa remains near the top of the county in number of cases per capita in the New York Times COVID-19 trackers listing of cases over the previous 7 days. The state was at 109 cases per 100,000 population, 5th highest in the U.S. on Monday afternoon. Potawatomi County was at 105.1 cases per 100,000. Here are COVID-19 information and resources. Symptoms in people who have been exposed to coronavirus can include fever, cough, and shortness of breath, according to the Iowa Department of Public Health. The symptoms may appear as a few days or as long as 14 days after exposure. Most people experience mild or moderate symptoms that clear up in 2 to 3 weeks. Older adults and people with existing health problems are among those particularly susceptible to more severe illness, including pneumonia. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommend the use of masks when out in public. Make sure it covers the mouth and nose. Face shields are an option as well, as they cover the eyes. Public health officials recommend staying home as much as possible, self-monitoring for symptoms, calling your physician if symptoms appear, covering coughs and sneezes with a tissue or your upper arm/elbow, cleaning and disinfecting frequently touched objects and surfaces, washing hands frequently with soap and water. COVID-19 testing is available in Potawatomi County via 2 Test Iowa locations, All Health Care Center, 902 South 6th Street, and Western Historic Trail Center, 3434 Richard Downing Avenue. To get tested, residents must complete the online assessment at testiowa.com to schedule an appointment. For those struggling with mental health during the pandemic, yourlifeiowa.org has several resources, including a hotline at 855-581-8111 and a text-friendly line at 855-895-8398. The University of Nebraska Medical Center has a COVID-19 screening app, One Check COVID. Vice President Mike Pence to make campaign stop in Carter Lake this week. The Trump campaign announced that Pence will host a Make America Great Again event at Owen Industries Incorporated in Carter Lake on Thursday. The event is set for noon, but doors open 2 hours before that. Not only is Iowa one of the states in play for the 2020 presidential contest, but Nebraska's Omaha-based 2nd Congressional District is also up for grabs. While it only represents a single electoral vote, some projections show it should prove pivotal. The announcement of Pence's visit this week focused on agricultural policy, alleging that Democrats' presidential nominee Joe Biden would hurt Iowa farms with its tax and environmental policies. Democrats have made the case they're better for farms in part because of the toll on farm country for the administration made disputes. 2-year-old girl dies after being hit by vehicle in Council Bluffs. A 2-year-old girl died Saturday after being hit by a car pulling into a driveway in Council Bluffs, police said. Council Bluffs police were sent to the 300 block of Lincoln Avenue around 1:05 p.m. The Council Bluffs Fire Department already was at the scene, treating the girl. Then she was taken to the Nebraska Medical Center in Omaha, where she was pronounced dead. September 29th, face of the day, Kylie Gardner. Kylie Gardner just started her last year of middle school, but she's already looking forward to becoming a Lynx. Gardner, 13, is a native of Tabor. She attended Fremont Mills Elementary School, but moved to Council Bluffs with her family in the middle of her first grade year in 2014. She then attended Lewis and Clark Elementary School before making her way to Kern Middle School, where she's now an 8th grader. She said it's been an interesting few years, attending Kern pre-renovations, then studying at Council Bluffs Community School District's Madison campus last year, and now finishing her middle school career at the new and improved Kern facility. Gardner said she really likes the changes inside her school, noting a few more efficient layouts and a fresh, modern look. "I think it's really nice," she said. "It's more spaced out and easier to navigate. Before, our core classes were all spread out, and now each grade has their own designed pods." Gardner said she's really excited to take the step up to Abraham Lincoln High School next fall. She said she's been looking forward to being in a bigger school with more students to meet, and is dedicated as a volleyball player. She's ready to compete on a higher level. She's been playing the sport since she was 6 and plays for her school and a club program. She said she's going to try out for Nebraska Elite Volleyball in Omaha soon. Gardner said playing volleyball has taught her how to work better as a teammate and has also taught her to not get caught up when making a mistake, but rather learn from it and improve. And of course, she loves the thrill of competition. Outside of school and volleyball, Gardner studies dance at a Step Ahead dance studio and gymnastics center. She also loves spending time with her siblings, Addison and Nora, her mom, Kelly Blair, her dad, Craig Gardner, and her stepdad, Chris Blair. She's enjoying the recent fall weather, but she loves donning a jacket to go on walks. When it's chillier, she said she'll cozy up inside with some board games and television. That is when she's not too busy with her volleyball schedule. Gardner is looking forward to a strong finish to her time at Kern. She's also looking forward to a bright future at AL. Sun says Branstad definitely in campaign mode. Former Governor Terry Branstad will return to Iowa on Saturday, just in time for the start of early voting and to spend the next 4 weeks on the campaign trail. "He's very, very excited to get back," Eric Branstad, senior advisor to President Donald Trump's Iowa campaign, said about his father. "He wants to be everywhere, doing everything to support, certainly our local legislative candidates, our congressional candidates, Senator Joni Ernst, and certainly the president. So he's going to be really all over the state of Iowa and beyond," Branstad said about his father, who recently announced his resignation as ambassador to China after 3 years there. 29 days of early voting. In-person were available and mail-in ballots begins Saturday. The younger Branstad plans to put his father to work as soon as he gets back to Iowa. He's working on his father's former aides to fill out his schedule. "He thinks the elder Branstad, 73, will be an asset because he's always been successful, undefeated in 14 primary and general election contests. And he's definitely in campaign mode," Eric Branstad said. "We'll have him scheduled fully every day for 28 days, and there's only one level of work that he does, and that is turbo. He's ready to put in that turbo kind of effort for all our candidates up and down across Iowa." Branstad's presence on the campaign trail will add to an already high level of enthusiasm for the president's re-election, Eric Branstad said. "What I've been hearing is the president's support and the energy surrounding our campaigns really like I've never seen it before," said Branstad, who's logged more than 8,000 miles crisscrossing the state in the past 3 weeks. The campaign has made nearly 2 million voter contracts and boat parades, tractor parades, and bus tours demonstrate support of the local president's agenda and accomplishments, he said. For information on absentee voting, please visit the website of the Iowa Security of State. Ask the weather guys, how does weather affect fall colors? Question, how does weather affect fall colors? A. Astronomical fall began on September 22nd. Climatologists consider fall as the months of September, October, and November. The fall season is also associated with pumpkin patches, fresh apples, and beautiful foliage. Leaves are green in the summer because they contain chlorophyll, which reflects green light more than other colors. Other colors are absorbed by chlorophyll for photosynthesis. During autumn, the green chlorophyll disappears from the leaves as the leaves stop their food-making process and yellow and orange appears. These colors have been in the leaves all along, but we can't see them in the summer because of chlorophyll. The orange color comes from carotene, and the yellow comes from xanthophyll. The bright red and purple colors come from anthocyanin pigments, which are made from leftover glucose trapped within the leaves of some trees, such as maples. Brilliant fall colors with bright red and purple colors require conditions in which leaves can make a lot of anthocyanin pigments. The brilliance of a fall color season is a function of the weather. Sunny days and cool nights are the key weather ingredient for brilliant fall colors. The best weather conditions are bright sunny days and cool, but not frosty nights. A drab autumn has lots of cloudy days and warm nights. Leaves begin to turn before we have any frosts. An early frost speeds up the fall of the leaves and brings a quicker end to the fall. A few hard frosts can cause the leaves to wither and fall from the tree without changing color. Many southern Wisconsin regions have not experienced frost. Of course, too much winds or a heavy precipitation would bring the leaves down. The pandemic has reduced the travel plans of many, but this weekend might be a good time to go for a ride to see the colors. Judge upholds GOP lawmaking absentee voting harder in Iowa. A judge is refusing to block a new Republican-backed Iowa law that makes it harder for county officials to process absentee ballot applications and more likely that incomplete requests won't be fulfilled. In an opinion dated Friday and released Monday, Judge Lars Anderson rejected arguments by a Latino civil rights organization and a Democratic Party group that the law is an undue burden on the fundamental right to vote. The ruling is another victory for Republicans who want to limit absentee voting, which begins next week in Iowa. The Trump campaign and Republican Party groups have already invalidated tens of thousands of absentee ballot applications returned by voters in three counties. At issue is a law passed this summer that blocks county auditors from using their databases to fill in any missing information on voters' absentee ballot applications. County officials say a small percentage of voters routinely leave blank their driver's license or voter PIN numbers, either of which must be included on the application. Few even know their PIN numbers. In past elections, county auditors could look up missing PIN numbers in their databases and fill in the information. The new law, instead, requires that they contact those voters by phone, email, or mail to get them to provide that information. County officials say contacting potentially tens of thousands of voters will be unnecessarily burdensome and that some may not be reachable before the deadline to qualify for absentee ballots. Those voters would have to vote in person during the coronavirus pandemic. Supporters of the law argue that requiring voters to submit their identification information is an important safeguard against fraud. A lawsuit filed in July by the League of United Latin American Citizens and Majorly Forwarded, a group aligned with Senate Democrats, sought to block enforcement of the law, arguing it's unconstitutional, likely to disenfranchise eligible voters. But Anderson sided with Republicans who argued that absentee ballot requests do not affect the fundamental right to vote. He said voters whose requests are not properly can always vote on election day at his or her polling place. He noted that the law was passed on a party-line vote and reflects policy decisions with which many disagree, but he can't second-guess lawmakers because the law isn't constitutionally defective. He found the law has been related to a legitimate government interest and unlikely to be considered overly burdensome. Probably identifying absentee ballot requests and requiring a voter to provide identification information fits the interests of the state in maintaining integrity of the election process, he wrote. To blunt the impact of the new law, Elections Commissioner Lynn Johnson in Woodbury counties this summer sent absentee ballot request forms to voters with their PIN numbers and other information already filled in. Voters just had to review, sign, and mail back the forms to request absentee ballots. The Trump campaign and Republican Party groups sued last month to invalidate those forms, saying they violated a directive from Secretary of State Paul Pate to mail them out blank to ensure uniformity statewide. Judges quickly agreed in three separate cases, ordering counties to nullify more than 75,000 requests that had already been submitted and not to process thousands more that were outstanding. Voters in those countries would have to fill out a new blank form to request absentee ballots, which will be mailed out beginning October 5th. Even though the Democratic-backed challenge to the new laws was filed on Monday before Trump's lawsuits, the court did not hold a hearing in the case until last week. Judge Christopher Bruns had declined to hear the challenge on an emergency basis in August, saying the pandemic has resulted in significant delays in cases and a significant backlog of criminal and family law cases that took priority. You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Tuesday, September 29th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Kylie from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners, so if you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. Now we're going to look at the opinion pieces. Mitt Romney, Washington's Lone Ranger. Some have said that in a fair and high righteous world, the seat held by the late Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg would be filled next January by the recently elected President of the United States. But we know our world to be otherwise, and the seat will be filled as soon as possible thanks to Senator Mitt Romney, whose decision not to block a vote before the election gave Majority Leader Mitch McConnell the green light to proceed with the nomination process. It seems to be Romney's fate to be permanently affixed to the public whipping post, no matter what he does. He's the guy who can't please anyone, and who, unbeknownst to most, is humble enough to accept that fate. In that rarest of qualities among politicians, his conscience truly is his guide. I say this from having known Romney for more than a decade, though he often has trouble connecting to voters in public venues. This private man is among the very few to whom I would ascribe noble intentions. Maybe it's the Mormon faith, but Romney has no affinity for the easy path. Indeed, at this point, self-immolation might have some appeal. His choice to follow President Trump's lead and follow the confirmation process to go forward has only earned him new enemies. In the nation's capital, Romney remains the loneliest ranger, loved by none, hated by returns by nearly all. In February, when he was the sole Republican to vote for Trump's conviction in his impeachment trial, Romney briefly enjoyed the adoration of the left. Profiles and courage were written, and the Utah senator was feted as the right kind of Republican, one who votes his conscience even when it hurts him personally. At the same time, the right pillared and reviled him. Trump backers deemed with a traitor and a self-serving revenge seeker. That was then. Today, Romney's reviled by the left and center for clearing a way for a 6-3 conservative majority on the Supreme Court, and yet the right still despises him. One thing you can say about conservatives, they are loath to liberate a grudge. Sometimes wrong, but never in doubt. Republicans can zip up in a tent so tight that a mosquito can't get in. The warmer-blooded Democrats, though perhaps utilitarian at heart, will leave the flap open on the chance of a potential convert wanders by. Some may claim that Romney's ultimate decision was never in doubt. Power is power, but this world misunderstood the man and how he operates. His closest associates have spoken often of his sometimes aggravating decision-making style, which is to tackle any issue as though he were writing a dissertation on the subject. As governor of Massachusetts, he sought tutoring and guidance from scientists and bioethicists when considering legislation related to stem cell research. During the impeachment, he requested transcripts of testimony, studying and praying, late into the night. People close to him during the latest deliberations tell me he was once more concerned about making the right decision. The stakes seem almost insurmountable. Not only would his decision affect the high court for decades, but also the pushback either way would be ferocious and unyielding. Both sides brought pressure to bear during his days of rumination, including from trusted advisors urging him to vote no. True enough, Romney wouldn't have wanted to help Trump win re-election. Everyone knows he's not a Trump buddy. Since he was elected in 2016, Trump has made no attempt to conceal his contempt for Romney, whom he pretended to woo as a possible pick for Secretary of State. Everything one knew that nomination was never going to happen, and when Trump rejected Romney just as he met his predicted, the senator handled it with characteristic grace, even if the humiliation had to sting. It is the essence of irony that Romney should now be on the side of his nemesis, but the long-sought goal of a conservative court to serve as bulwark against progressive domination in other branches of government ultimately guided Romney to yes. Someday, perhaps, Republicans may show some gratitude for what I never was an easy call. Either way, the Romney I know doesn't care. It was never personal. For obituaries, here are death notices for September 29th, 2020. Rose Etta Andrews, 78. John P. Martins, 73. Penny Elizabeth Odison, 50. Gerald Henry Roby, 80. John P. Martins. John P. Martins, age 73, of Council Bluffs, passed away September 26, 2020, at his home. John was born May 29, 1947, in Council Bluffs, to the late Leo E. and Gretchen Wintgate Martins. He graduated from Thomas Jefferson High School in 1965 and proudly served his country in the U.S. Air Force during the Vietnam War. John was the chief of engineers in the hotel industry for 40 years, retiring in 2007. He was a member of Excelsior Masonic Lodge No. 259, AF and AM, in Tangier Shrine. He is survived by Sue Martins of Council Bluffs, Steve and wife Kathy Martins for Gold Canyon, Arizona, and Patrick Martins. Graveside serving and burial Friday, 10 a.m. in Cedar Lawn Cemetery. Military honors will be tendered by the Canesville Honor Guard. Memorial contributions may be made to the Tangerine site. Penny Elizabeth Audison. Penny Elizabeth Audison passed away September 23, 2020, with her family by her side. She was born in Council Bluffs, Iowa on November 30, 1970 and graduated from Thomas Jefferson High School in 1989. Penny is preceded in death by her parents, Joseph and Delia Audison, brothers Donnie, John, and Joey. Survivors include daughter Molly Rose Audison, siblings Charlie Audison, Connie Wold, Lenny Wood, Cliff Audison, two aunts and one uncle, many nieces, nephews, cousins, and numerous friends. Penny will sadly be missed by everyone that knew her. Celebration of Life will be Wednesday, September 30th, 2020, 4 to 6 p.m. at Hoy Kalinske Funeral Home. Inurnment at a later date. In lieu of flowers, the family will direct memorials. Gerald Henry Roby. Gerald Henry Roby was age 80. Council Bluffs passed away September 27, 2020 at Ridgecrest Rehabilitation Center in Omaha. Gerald was born July 17, 1940 in Council Bluffs to the late Charles and Layla Roby and graduated from Abraham Lincoln High School. He worked many years for Getty Oil as their safety construction engineer. Gerald is also preceded in death by his brother Vernon and great-granddaughter Marley. Survivors include son Rob Roby, Council Bluffs' daughters Lori Ernst, Casey Moe, Terry Roby Kerbis, B.B. Town, son Mike Roby, Council Bluffs' 8 grandchildren, 6 great-grandchildren, brothers Wayne Roby, Glenn Roby, all Omaha. Celebration of Life visitation for Gerald will be Wednesday, 6 to 8 p.m. at Cutler, O'Neill, Meyer, Woodring, Bayless Park Chapel. COVID-19 precautions will be observed with masks encouraged. Memorials to Hillcrest Hospice in Omaha and Ridgecrest Rehabilitation Center in Omaha. Gerald will be interred at Hazel Dell Cemetery. Rosetta Andrews. Rosetta Andrews, age 78, passed away September 26, 2020 at CHI Mercy Hospital. Rose was born May 29, 1942 in Council Bluffs to the late Josh and Frances Andrews and worked most of her life in food service and entertainment. She is preceded in death by her parents and sisters Pam Andrews and Mary Hires. Rose is served by her children Debbie Gordon, Council Bluffs Tammy Legit, Omaha Mike Legit, Sandy Legit, all Council Bluffs, 8 grandchildren, 13 great-grandchildren, Rose's siblings Joanne Weinart, Millard, Jim Andrews, Sandy Andrews, Mark Andrews, many nieces and nephews. Visitation with family Wednesday 5 to 8 p.m. Funeral services Thursday 10:30 a.m. all at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Bayless Park Chapel. Rose will be laid to rest in Memorial Park Cemetery. Family will direct memorials. Luncheon to follow at Walnut Hill Reception Center. Now we have some sports stories. For our first story on the front page of sports, we have NBA. Lakers Heat start their preparations for NBA Finals. Bam Adebayo woke up on Monday with the realization that only 2 teams still have a chance to win this season's NBA championship. Goosebumps kicked in at the thought. What was once a 22-team double at Walt Disney World is down to the final 2, with Adebayo and the Miami Heat set to take on LeBron James and the Los Angeles Lakers in the NBA Finals that start on Wednesday night. It's the first finals matchup between the clubs, with the Lakers looking for a record-tying 17th title and the Heat seeking their 4th in the last 15 seasons. It's pretty cool considering, when you think about it, It's you and one other team that are still left standing, and one of the two will be raising the Larry O'Brien Trophy, Arbeo said Monday. But we know that job isn't done yet. The Heat were spending much of Monday resting up before an evening team meeting would officially start their finals preparation process. The Lakers, who won the Western Conference Finals on Saturday, a day before Miami finished off the Eastern Conference crown, were starting to get their game plan in order after a one-day break as well. Much like the Heat, the Lakers took a moment to enjoy winning the conference title. Winning a day ahead of Miami just happens to give the Lakers a bit more time to prepare for Game 1. We appropriately had fun with it that night, enjoyed it that night. And then the next day, it's time to move on to the next. And now it's all business, Lakers coach Frank Vogel said Monday. I don't think there's any kind of an eye towards the end of getting home or anything like that. It's really about staying single-minded in our focus about what needs to happen for us to beat Miami Heat. Both teams are scheduled for regular practices Tuesday. It's definitely a tight squeeze, preparation-wise, compared to last year. The 2019 NBA Finals started on May 30th, with Golden State clinching its spot in the title series on May 20th, and Toronto on May 25th. I tell you, it's going to be brutalizing for our video staff, Heat coach Eric Spoelstra said. The Heat, who ousted East number one seed Milwaukee in the second round, are trying to become the second team in the last 18 seasons to beat a pair of number one seeds in the next same playoff. Toronto did it last year, first to Milwaukee, then to Golden State. Before that, one would have to go back to 2002 when the Lakers pulled off the feat. I'm full of emotions, Heat guard Goran Dragic said. I'm happy. I've been waiting for this for a long time, for 11, 12 years, and finally I'm here. All the credit goes to those guys who are believing it and to my teammates. I'm just happy. I've been through a lot in those 5 years, ups and downs, and I'm just happy to be here and be part of the big moment. Can't wait for the finals. The Heat celebrated into the wee hours of Monday morning before retiring to their rooms and a few hours of sleep. Adebayo says he enjoyed himself, within reason. I had a Shirley Temple, he said. The bubble's been a grind. By game four or so of this series, the Lakers and Heat will have been at Disney for 3 months. A few players have family or friends there now, but for the most part, they've been isolated throughout the process. It was tough mentally, it was tough physically, playing every day for the most once the season resumed on July 30th. But all the teams have to get through now is one more series. We're super locked in, Vogel said. Our group enjoys each other. We've been through a lot. Even though we were really assembled this year, not a team that's been together for multiple years with everything that we've been through. Our chemistry's strong, and you know, I think the fact that we enjoy each other away from the basketball courts really helps with the bubble environment, and hopefully that'll continue for us. Next up, we have pandemic playoffs, Brewers, Astros, and despite losing records. Christian Yelich and the Milwaukee Brewers got off to a rags start this year. They never got above .500, and they dropped their last game to finish with a losing record. Guess what? They're going to the playoffs. Weird, I guess that's the only way to describe it. It's fitting for 2020, Yelich said Sunday. A pandemic-altered 60-game regular season that many believed would never get completed and saw games postponed because of the coronavirus outbreaks, racial injustice protests, and a hurricane went into the final day without a single playoff setup match. Then, in a flurry and fury, the entire expanded 16-team postseason field was full. Not a bad way to start. Either Garrett Cole versus Shane Bieber in a mega-watt duel as the Yankees for New York faced the Cleveland Indians in the best-of-three wild-card round Tuesday. On Wednesday, the NL gets going. That's when the Brewers, at 29-31, open their series against Los Angeles, our Walker Buehler at Dodger Stadium. In a win and you're in game, St. Louis clinched by beating Milwaukee 5-2, but the Brewers also made it when San Francisco lost 5-4 to San Diego, the last wild card spot. Yelich, the former MVP who hit .205 this year after winning the last two NL batting titles, and the Brewers happily posed for a team picture on their playoff cinch t-shirts on the Busch Stadium field. The Astros and first-year manager Dusty Baker also are in the 29-31 Houston, got its shot by finishing second in the AL West, drawing an automatic berth. The only other team in a major league history to reach the playoffs with a losing record was the 1981 Kansas City Royals at 50-53 overall. They made it by winning the second half in a strike-split season. It's a celebration we're in. We're in the playoffs. That's how you see it, Brewers manager Craig Counsell said. there's no reason to apologize for getting into the playoffs. The record's kind of irrelevant in my opinion, he said. The other AL pairings, top-seeded Tampa Bay number 8, Toronto number 2, Oakland number 7, Chicago White Sox, and number 3, Minnesota number 6, Houston, with all openers Tuesday. In the NL, it's number 1, Dodgers, number 1, 8, Brewers, number 2, Atlanta, number 7, Cincinnati, number 3, Chicago Cubs, number 6, Miami, and number 4, San Diego, number 5, St. Louis on Wednesday. Yadier Molina and the Guardians claimed their spot despite missing 2.5 weeks into August after the club was hit by a virus outbreak. St. Louis played a total of 58 games. It was prepared for a doubleheader in Detroit on Monday, if needed, to settle the playoff picture. You had to throw some of the expectations out the window not knowing what to expect after talking those couple weeks off and all those doubleheaders. So many new guys, Cardinals first baseman Paul Goldschmidt said. Very different when fulfilling to make the playoffs. All matchups are best of three, with every game hosted by the top seed in ballparks without fans. With no days off, pitching strategies will be paramount, particularly how managers use their bullpens. Following the wild card rounds, the remaining clubs will move to neutral site bubbles in Texas and Southern California to crown a champion. The biggest losers Sunday were Philadelphia and the Giants. As it turned out, either team would have gotten in with a win. It's tough sitting here and not thinking about the playoffs, Phillies slugger Bryce Harper said after a 5-0 loss at Tampa Bay. We had opportunities to win games and we just didn't get it done. October on deck means the end of 7-inning games and no more automatic runners at a second base to begin the 10th. But other new rules implemented this season apply. Designated hitters in the National League and relievers must face 3 batters or end the inning. Nothing else kooky in this 16-team tournament, though, like no penalty at-bats to decide extra long games. It's going to be wild, everything about it, Rays outfielder Kevin Kiermaier said as the playoffs approached. Anything can happen, we all know that, and that's why I think it's going to be a must-see TV throughout both leagues. It is. I think there's going to be a lot of surprises, American League, National League, just with the 3-game format for the first round, he said. Nothing scheduled for Monday, but the day after the season's typically busy too, especially for managers on shaky ground. The Red Sox said Sunday that Ron Roniker won't be back next year, and the Angels fired general manager Billy Epler. Every team, meanwhile, hopes to be healthy. Star outfielders Mookie Betts, the Dodgers, and Ronald Acuña Jr. of the Braves are ailing. Martins outfielder Starling Mart and pitcher Jose Urena left Sunday's game with injuries. Kind of your biggest fear on a day like today, Marlins manager Don Mattingly said after a 5-0 win at Yankee Stadium. You hate to be playing your guys, almost. Dodgers newcomer David Price, Cardinals reliever John Hicks, and White Sox pitcher Michael Kopech are among the players who opted out before the season began and will be absent in the playoffs. Atlanta outfielder Nick Markakis chose not to play, then returned in early August. Now for some hockey, NHL bubble hockey champions, Tampa Bay Lightning win Stanley Cup. The Tampa Bay Lightning are the champions of bubble hockey. Braden Point scored his playoff best 14th goal and the Lightning beat the Dallas Stars 2-0 on Monday night to win the Stanley Cup and finish off the most unusual NHL postseason in history, staged nearly entirely in quarantine because of the pandemic. The clock hitting zeros in an empty arena, nonetheless, set off a joyful celebration for a team that endured years of playoff heartbreak and 2 months in isolation. Goals from Point and Blake Coleman and a 22-save shutout by Andrei Vasilevskiy in Game 6 were enough to power the Lightning to their second championship after winning it in 2004. That also came with the league on the verge of a labor stoppage, a lockout that wiped out an entire season, and similar uncertainty hangs in the air now because of the coronavirus. Questions about the future were put off for a celebration by the Lightning and the NHL. Getting this done was a triumph of sorts, financial woes not worth standing. The NHL is the first of the 4 major North American professional sports leagues to crown a champion since the start of the pandemic. Tampa Bay's core group closed out the final with an almost poetic display of what got the Lightning to this point over the past several years and months. Their new star in Point scored a power play goal in the first period with assists from longtime standouts Nikita Kucherov and Victor Hedman. Key addition Coleman killed a penalty and scored on an old man rush in second, and Vasilevskiy did his job on a relatively slow night in net. It was more of a coronation than a challenge as the dominant Lightning outshot the Stars 29-22 and looked like the powerhouse they've been for much of the past decade. In the final alone, Tampa Bay's power play was clicking and turned the series around. Points goal made it 7-for-16 over the past 5 games to decimate the Stars, who were outdone by their lack of discipline and couldn't get enough Dobie magic from goaltender Anton Kudon. The Stars simply ran out of gas after injuries piled up. Rick Bowness, an assistant for the Tampa Bay for 5 years, who was part of the 2015 run that fell short in the final, faced his own uncertain future as interim head coach. The Lightning did to the Stars what Chicago did to them in the 2015 final when injuries built up. Two center Anthony Cirelli, playing hurt this time, didn't have injured captain Steven Stamkos for almost all of the playoffs and still survived. Here's a college football story. Stat watch. Baylor's versatile Ebner makes Big 12 history. Tristan Ebner turned in a once-in-a-quarter-century performance. The Baylor senior became the first player in the 25-year history of the Big 12 to score 3 different types of touchdowns in a game, and the first FBS player since 1996 to score a rushing touchdown, a receiving touchdown, and multiple return touchdowns in a game. Ebner finished with 272 all-purpose yards in the Bears' 47-14 win over Kansas, the third highest total in program history and the most in the nation this season. Ebner scored on a 1-yard run and an 18-yard pass from Charlie Brewer before he ran back the second half kickoff 100 yards and returned a free kickoff 87 yards for a score after a safety. Ebner's 4 touchdowns in Baylor's opener were one of his total of 5 in 2019. Pitt's party. Kyle Pitts' big day in Florida's 51-37 win over Mississippi was the kind rarely seen by a tight end. His 8 catches for 170 yards and 4 touchdowns made him only the third FBS tight end since at least 1996 with at least 150 receiving yards and 4 touchdowns in a game. The others were Stanford's Colby Parkinson in 2018 and Kentucky's James Wallen Jr. in 1999. Pitts' 4 receiving touchdowns were the most by a Florida player since Ike Hilliard had the same number against Tennessee in 1995. His receiving yards total was the highest by a Gator since Demarcus Robinson's 216 against Kentucky in 2014. Biggest blown lead. Oklahoma's 21-point lead against Kansas State was the biggest the Sooners had ever blown in a loss, according to OU research. The then number 3 Sooners, who lost 38-35, led 35-14 with 2 minutes and 46 seconds left in the third quarter, before the Wildcats rallied for their biggest come-from-behind win since they beat Iowa State in 2015. Before Saturday, the Sooners had never squandered a lead greater than 17 points in a loss. That happened 3 times in 1999 against Texas and Dallas, Georgia, in the college football playoff semifinal at the Rose Bowl. ACC turnovers. 4 of the 6 teams with the most turnovers are from the ACC. Duke has committed 14, most in the nation, and is followed by Georgia Tech with 12. Louisianaville has the 4th most in the country at 8, and Florida State is tied for 5th with 6. Bailey's back. Iowa State's Jaquan Bailey, who missed the last 9 games in 2019 with a leg injury, is back at the top form. His school record tying 3.5 sacks and a 37-34 win over TCU made him the Cyclones' all-time leader with 22. He also became ISU's career leader in tackles for loss, with his 4 against the Horned Frogs giving him 36.5. His sack total against TCU was the Cyclones' highest since Jason Berryman and the same number against TCU in the 2015 Houston Bowl. Here's a story from Records. Amazon to kick off holiday shopping with Prime Day on October 13th and 14th. Amazon is aiming to kickstart the holiday shopping season early this year. The company is holding its annual Prime Day over 2 days in October this year, after the pandemic forced it to postpone the sales event from July. It's the first time Prime Day is being held in the fall, and Amazon is positioning it as a way to get people to start their holiday shopping. Even before Amazon's announcement Monday, major retailers have said they plan to rush shoppers to start their holiday shopping in October and offer deals earlier, hoping to avoid crowds in their stores in November and December. Prime Day, which will be run from October 13th to October 14th this year, is sure to put pressure on rivals to offer deals around the same time. In past years, Walmart, Best Buy, and Target have offered their own online discounts during Prime Day. In fact, Target announced on Monday it was also holding a 2-day sale event on October 13th and October 14th. Amazon started the sales event in 2015 as its answer to Singles Day, a shopping holiday in China popularized by Chinese e-commerce company Alibaba. Now we have 176-year-old slave sale block set to be displayed in museum with context. A 176-year-old stone block that was used for slave auctions in Virginia will go on display at the Fredericksburg Area Museum with signs explaining the context of recent protests against racial injustice that left it covered in graffiti. The knee-high stone block sat for nearly two centuries in downtown Fredericksburg until the city removed it recently. Now it's on a loan to the museum, which will put it in the display by mid-November with the graffiti still intact. The Freelance Star reported Sunday. Sarah Poore, the museum's president and CEO, said visitors will have the option to see the actual stone or just an image of it, and there will be a clear signage that indicates the tone of the graffiti. We'll also discuss the recent events and the impact the stone has had on the conversation, Poore said. It's our goal to use the stone as a springboard for community conversations. The city pulled the 800-pound, 363-kilogram marker from the ground in June after its removal was delayed 4 months by lawsuits in the coronavirus pandemic. The weathered stone was sprayed with graffiti and chants of "Move the Block" erupted during local demonstrations over the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis City, officials said. As a local chapter of the NAACP called for stone's removal in 2017, saying it was a relic of a time of hatred and degradation that should not be displayed along a main thoroughfare. All right, and that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Tuesday, September 29th, 2020. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 3 p.m. Iris volunteers love to hear from listeners, so again, if you have any comments or questions about today's broadcast or an Iris program, please call the toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. I'm Kylie from Drake University in Des Moines, and thank you for listening.
In the People's Pharmacy Health Headlines, flu season should be winding down, but the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are warning about a second wave of influenza peaking in the southeastern U.S. Earlier this year, tests showed that the most common strain of flu virus was H1N1. Now, however, the H3N2 strain is becoming more common. That's the strain that caused such a terrible flu season last year. Both strains are covered in this year's flu vaccine, and experts report that the flu shot reduced the number of cases that needed medical attention by 47%. There is a new oral antiviral drug this year called Xofluza. One dose is all that's necessary to shorten the duration of influenza symptoms.
The first really new antidepressant recently won FDA approval for treatment-resistant depression. Esketamine nasal spray will be sold under the brand name Spravato. Physicians and patients have been eagerly awaiting the arrival of this new type of antidepressant. They may be shocked by the price. People starting on this medication will need twice-a-week dosing for the first month. The list price is roughly $600 to $900 per dose. That means the initial month could cost as much as $6,800. After that, people will require once weekly or twice monthly nasal spray administration. Those costs would range from $2,300 to $3,500. At the end of a year, Spravato could end up costing $45,000. Some insurance companies may balk at that expense.
For years, health experts have been telling people that exercise is critical for good health and that walking is great exercise. Dog ownership can contribute. People who walk their dogs regularly get more exercise than people without pets. A study published in JAMA Surgery highlighted a downside of this otherwise pleasant activity, however. Dog ownership has increased in the U.S. over the last decade, but so have broken bones among older people out walking their dogs. Such fractures doubled between 2004 and 2017, with the majority of broken bones in women. About half of the breaks were in arms, wrists, or fingers. The other fractures, unfortunately, were more concerning. About 17% of the broken bones were hips, a situation that can have serious negative consequences for a person's mobility or even survival. The scientists recommend obedience training for pets so that they don't tug at the leash suddenly and tip a person over. In addition, it makes sense to match the dog and its temperament to the strength of the owner.
Week after week, the FDA has announced recalls of contaminated blood pressure drugs called angiotensin receptor blockers, or ARBs. So many lots of valsartan, irbesartan, and losartan have been removed from the market that there are serious shortages. To cope with this growing problem, the FDA has expedited the review of additional ARB products. This week, the agency announced that it had approved a new generic valsartan from Alkem Laboratories in India. The FDA reports that its evaluation of Alkem's manufacturing process does not indicate a likelihood of contamination with nitrosamine carcinogens.
New technology that allows for non-invasive imaging of the retina may allow eye doctors to diagnose Alzheimer's disease. The retina is richly supplied with blood through a dense network of fine blood vessels. In Alzheimer's disease, however, this network thins and becomes more sparse. Possibly, this reflects what's happening elsewhere in the brain as well. The imaging is optical coherence tomography angiography. Researchers at the Duke Eye Center compared the retinas of 39 people with Alzheimer's disease to the retinas of 37 people with mild cognitive impairment and 133 people with healthy cognitive function. In addition to the loss of tiny blood vessels in the retina, a specific layer of the retina was thinner in people with Alzheimer's disease. These changes did not show up in people with mild cognitive impairment. This is the second time within the past few months we've heard about the possibility that optical coherence tomography angiography may offer an early diagnosis for Alzheimer's disease. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.